This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This is not the future we were promised. Like, how about that for a tagline for the show?
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work and your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. From BBC Radio 4.
About 9 o'clock last Saturday night, I had gone down to a grocer's shop in Blair Street at the foot of the stair. One of my lodgers came into the shop saying that they were all to be murdered in my house, and she begged me to come back. I went immediately.
We'd had a few drinks and ended up in 82 Southbridge Street. We were prevented from leaving there by three women between us and a door, but we pushed through, leading to a struggle in the passage.
I went to fetch Mrs. McKinnon and I told her of the noise in the house. I was then knocked over in the front room. I was scared and kept out the way.
This is Lady Killers, the series where ordinary women act in extraordinary ways. I'll be joined by an all-female team of detectives to examine the wild and unthinkable crimes from history, supposedly committed by different murderesses from the UK, North America, and Australia. And we'll be looking at them afresh through the eyes of modern feminists. Today we're looking at Mary McKinnon. You just heard her being alerted to a potential murder in her lodging house or tavern in Edinburgh. With me to discuss the case is Dr. Anastasia Ryan, founder of SISU, a Glasgow-based charity for women at risk and a lecturer in social policy at the University of Glasgow.
Hi, Lucy.
Also joining us is our resident historian, Professor Rosalind Crone from the Open University. Ros, hello.
Hi, Lucy.
Great to have you with us. Now, let's get into what happened on the night of the crime in question. It's the 8th of February, 1823, in Edinburgh. Just as on any other evening, Mary McKinnon is running her tavern, but she decides to pop out for a drink with her friend, the grocer's wife. Meanwhile, it's a typical Saturday night for a group of lads. They've been drinking all afternoon, and now they're looking for entertainment. Having been turned away from quite a few places, they find Mary's tavern at 82 South Bridge. To begin with, it's all jolly and fun and the drinks are flowing. But suddenly, the party atmosphere turns sour. The group of men are causing trouble. They're starting to turn violent. And Mary is sent for. And what happens next depends on who you listen to.
A woman came out of the kitchen who swore they'd stab any man who left the house. And she came towards me with a knife. I tried to grab her hand, but missed it, and received the blow in my left breast.
McKinnon came into the kitchen and grabbed a knife. She said, "Stand back, let me get a knife. I'll soon settle the buggers." And she stabbed him.
McKinnon came in the kitchen and cried, "In the name of God, what is this?" Wilkinson knocked McKinnon down and tore her cap. I did not see Howitt at all, except sitting in the chair. And I did not see McKinnon with a knife in her hand.
I arrived at the house around 11 p.m. William Howitt was lifeless and had a weak pulse, so I bled him in both arms, and in 15 minutes he was having a drink.
When I arrived, there were cries of murder in the passage, and when I went forward towards the kitchen door, a man knocked me down and I was kicked again while I lay. When I got up from the floor, I saw a young man sitting in the chair, and he was already bleeding. I called the police. I tried to dress his wounds before the police surgeon arrived. I did not have a knife in my hand at any time.
Lots of contradictory stories here. Now, Mary's address is recorded as 82 South Bridge. It's quite likely, though, that her tavern was located in the vaulted passageways underneath this particular bridge. There are labyrinthine tunnels and chambers snaking about under much of Edinburgh's old town, used originally for storage until people moved in to use them as shops and homes. Lots of these vaults survive and give a sense of what the Southbridge neighbourhood was like 2 centuries ago. Roz and Anastasia went to visit the likely scene of the crime, and there they discovered that there's more to Mary's Tavern than meets the eye.
So we've entered the vaults now, and we're walking up the set of stairs. Gosh, it's dark. It's only lit by a few candles, and I feel like with no windows here, you've got no concept of what time it is outside. And these bricks that make up the walls and the arched roof, they're slimy and damp. It's a real eeriness and almost feeling of walking back in time. So let's go into this room here. Well, it's just off the passageway. These large rooms, almost cylinder shape, but still drippy and dark, and that smell of damp. So is this what Mary McKinnon's tavern would have been like?
We don't have many descriptions of Mary McKinnon's tavern. One that we do have describes a kind of outer door leading to a passage of about 20 foot with rooms coming off it, a kitchen and a couple other rooms. The room that the men were shown into when they arrived at the tavern is described as having a table, some chairs, sofa and a bed. So this is a place for drinking, for sociability and potentially other activities. It's interesting because it's called Mary McKinnon's Tavern. She also calls herself a lodging housekeeper as well. But it's clear that what's going on here is some kind of selling of sexual services as well.
If it was actually a brothel, we talk about sex work often being underground. I mean, we are literally underground. Is that what sex work was like back then?
Sex work like this in this kind of tavern situation is certainly located in kind of more working class communities. But it's not necessarily underground in the same way that we might think of nowadays. This is very much a community under here.
So what would it have been like then to be a sex worker in the 1800s or in the 1820s?
A good starting point for thinking about that is a book written by a doctor called William Tate. And he did a study of prostitution in Edinburgh and describes the scene from the 1820s and 1830s. He thought that the women who went into prostitution was partly because of their characters. He talked about how they had some kind of licentious inclination and they were dishonest and indolent. But he also talked about circumstances at the time that forced women into prostitution. So young girls who had been seduced and then left, and also the low wages that women were paid for other types of work. But these sorts of publications we have to be very, very careful with. There's a real moral tone to Tate's work, very much campaigning for the control and suppression of prostitution. Historians have become very good at kind of reading against the grain in these records and trying to get to the women themselves. A much more nuanced picture of prostitution emerges from that.
So interesting, the parallels with today and the idea of sex workers' voices being often invisibilized or co-opted by authorities, by academics, by politicians and campaigners. That silencing of women's voices within the industry really does shut down the debate around work within a context of capitalism, of the feminization of poverty, the impact of austerity measures, and really driving women into options within the context of having very limited options. So being in here, you can sense women working together, potentially camaraderie, and although we are actually underground, it feels less underground than it is today.
So, Mary McKinnon's tavern may also have been a brothel, or certainly providing some kind of sexual services. Was that common, Roz? It almost sounds like sex work was more closely woven into society than it is today.
Yes, I think that's fair to say that. It's quite hard to define a brothel at this time because it was mixed up with other activities, lodging houses, taverns, etc. And there were a lot of women in this industry, women like Mary McKinnon, who ran taverns, who ran lodging houses, poor women who were trying to make ends meet. And the girls that they had working alongside them would sell their services. There was a general acceptance of this kind of thing in working class communities. It's also important to note, though, that the 1820s represented a bit of a turning point. It was a time of increasing concern about order, about morality, and also about unregulated passion. And because of that, we see alongside that a kind of a growing or a reinvigorated moral discourse about prostitution, and also legislation that began to target these taverns, these lodging houses from the 1820s.
Anastasia, does this sound familiar to you?
What we see, I think, today is the legacy of that sense of control and immorality has really lasted in terms of the stigma and the surveillance of sex work in various and often contradictory ways. So laws and policies still in existence today that hark back to those times where sex workers were really being controlled to minimise public nuisance. So sex workers coming out into the public and that being seen as something that the authorities really had to clamp down on is still something that we see today, and that lasting sense effectively of criminalisation.
So are you saying, Anastasia, that as society from the 18th century onwards begins to think that sex work is something that should be policed, controlled, made a matter of stigma, does that potentially put the women doing it more at risk, would you say?
Yes, definitely. In two ways, I'd say. Firstly, in terms of at risk of policing and of criminalisation, arrest and prosecution, of course. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, it has created an environment in which sex workers are not seen as people. They're seen as disposable and seen as immoral.
On this Saturday night in Mary McKinnon's tavern or brothel, things turn ugly. The men start turning violent. Is that the sort of thing that you still hear from women working in this industry today that you've spoken to?
Yes, and I've worked in this area on the front line with sex workers for over 10 years. And here in the UK, what we find is that the legal framework actually exacerbates sex workers' vulnerability to violence. So sex workers are criminalised for solicitation on the street and therefore have to organise their work in much more hidden and isolated ways, therefore away from authorities and attention, trying to rush transactions with clients and therefore not being able to assess, for example, whether they might be seeming like they're drunk or that they are going to push their boundaries. Mostly the law impacts sex workers in that indoor sex workers are not allowed to work in pairs for safety. So the only legal way to sell sex in the UK is to work completely on your own. And we know that this heightens vulnerability to violence and makes sex workers really easy prey to potential perpetrators of violence.
I'm surprised by what you said. What's the thinking behind it being not allowed for two women to work in pairs for their safety?
So it really is related back to this turn within the 1800s where sex work or prostitution became regulated for two purposes, really. The first one, I think, to minimise public nuisance associated with sex work. But secondly, the brothels were also seen as places that were immoral and places in which public health became a concern. So we've seen that these brothels became criminalised. So two people working together for safety, regardless of whether one is managing the other or not, is effectively classed as running a brothel. And we've seen cases of women being arrested and prosecuted under those circumstances here in the UK.
My goodness, even if one of the women was the receptionist, as it were, crimes.
Yes, that person can be prosecuted for living on the earnings of prostitution, so living on immoral earnings.
Back in Mary McKinnon's tavern, Anastasia, if it was a brothel, and we think that it was, the clients were a group of lads out on the town. Is that what the clients of the women you've talked to today sound like?
So I think the parallel there would be with our adult entertainment industry clubs, so things like strip clubs.
Right.
And there we would see the clientele would predominantly be groups of young men on stag do's, for example. So still very much seen as entertainment, largely publicly acceptable. I think the more in-person and direct sex work venues such as saunas or escort agencies operate much more underground and more clandestine. But clients access and buy sexual services for a variety of reasons that are often overlooked. For example, grief, loneliness. We see many clients with disabilities use the services of a sex worker, for example. These things are often disregarded in a type of stereotyping of clients in the media particularly.
What you're saying, Anastasia, is that it's not all black and white.
It's not all black and white.
Well, on that Saturday night in February 1823, it's an indisputable fact that a man named William Howitt was stabbed and Mary McKinnon is arrested for the crime. The injured man is treated in the infirmary, where he gives a declaration that it was indeed Mary who'd stabbed him. And a few days later, he dies. On the 14th of March 1823, Mary is put on trial at the High Court Justiciary in Edinburgh. But she protests her innocence.
I do not know who gave Mr. Howitt the wound, but it was not from me. I didn't see anyone with a knife or weapon that could cause such a wound. I did not have a knife in my hand between the time I left the grocer's store and the time I was taken away by the police.
While Mary insists that she played no part in Howitt's death, his friend, Henry Kerr, corroborates Howitt's story, and the rest of the gang of men also give accounts that mostly match up. Did they collude? We don't know. But the evidence given by the women who were present in the tavern is much less tidy. In fact, it's a bit haphazard. The judge directs the jury to give more credit to the testimony of the men. And the judge even says to ignore the evidence of one of Mary McKinnon's lodgers because, and this is what he says, she was clearly a woman of vitiated character. That means that her character was spoiled, tainted by her job. Anastasia, to us it seems just wrong that the judge was saying, listen to the men and not the women. Does that have any echoes for you today? Have we got better than this?
Unfortunately, sex workers experience police being judgmental, misogynistic, almost an assumption that they've put themselves at risk of violence. So often sex workers are reluctant to report violence to the police in the first instance. We also have concrete cases. The most striking case that comes to mind is that of the brutal murder of Emma Caldwell in 2005 in Glasgow, in which the killer walked free for almost 17 years before even being brought to trial. And this was despite this man being interviewed in connection with Emma's death multiple times, almost over six times as a potential witness, and the testimony of some of the women who were also working at that time when Emma was, making clear that they suspected this man of being Emma's killer. One of the women, in fact, took the detectives pretty much to the exact same spot in which Emma's body was found in the end. And I think in these circumstances, women... testimonies, particularly where sex workers are not just the victim but also the witnesses, the discrediting of that due to their profession is very much intact today.
As a result of this direction from the judge, the jury takes only 20 minutes to return a verdict of guilty on Mary McKinnon. But they also recommend that mercy be given from the death sentence. Mary McKinnon's petition for mercy is sent down to London to the Home Secretary. It's still in the National Archives. And these papers give us more clues about who Mary McKinnon really was. Roz, you've got some copies here for us. What have you got?
I've got some excerpts with me from a much bigger folder of near 200 pages. And I have that copy of the petition here. So I'll pass you that to have a look at.
It's A, very slanted, and B, very tiny.
Yeah, but it's actually interesting because it outlines, first of all, the reasons why the jury thought mercy should be given in this case. And that included things like there was no malice, there was no intent to kill William Howitt, that the men turned up to her tavern in a state of drunkenness, and they shouldn't have, that they were violent towards the women, that was clear, and also the evidence from a man called Captain James Brown, who was a former superintendent of police. And he testified at trial that Mary McKinnon was of a humane and pleasant disposition. And furthermore, he had known her family. Now, according to Brown, Mary McKinnon had a terrible childhood. Her mother died when she was reasonably young, and her father was just terribly uncaring. He even accused the father of marrying a prostitute as well and bringing the prostitute into the house and providing a terrible example to Mary.
So when we've got the evidence of this policeman saying that he thinks Mary is the most unfortunate of the unfortunate, and he says here, her miseries began with her dad. How does this strike you, Anastasia? Familiar or different?
There's no one reason as to why women go into sex work in the first place, but we do see that in the majority of cases, money is the driver. But there's a various spectrum as to whether that is money really to survive, to keep a roof over their head, to feed their children, versus money out of financial aspirations. We see at the moment with the cost of living crisis, many women returning back to sex work or taking on new forms of sex work. So it's often used as a way to top up income.
You're really teaching us not to make assumptions here. gosh. Can I ask about the role of character references in this trial, Roz? Mary McKinnon apparently has a senior policeman speaking up for her. Did it do her any good?
If you read through the petition file, it always feels like a pretty tight case, and it feels like she's going to get off. She might get mercy.
Is she? Please tell me she is.
No.
No.
The Home Secretary, Robert Peel, apparently was very sympathetic to this case. But according to a member of her legal team, on the point of law, the fact that she had been convicted of murder in these circumstances meant that she couldn't get mercy.
So, Roz, it goes wrong for Mary McKinnon. At what point do you think that things just swing against her?
The point of trial, where the judge directs the jury to put more weight on the evidence of the men and to disregard some of the evidence of the women. That's where it goes wrong for Mary McKinnon.
So we think here we've got a miscarriage of justice. That's our inkling from the position where we are. And we think that that was the prejudices of the judge,
yes,
against somebody involved in this particular industry. Anastasia, please tell me that this could not happen today.
Sorry, Lucy. Women in sex work continue to be treated unfairly, and often I think the profession continues to cloud the judgments not just of the public but also of authorities and decision makers, including judges within our court system.
Now, because that petition for mercy gets refused, on the 18th of April 1823, Mary McKinnon is hanged. And that's all happened so quickly, hasn't it? February, March, April. Over in 3 months, her body's then given for dissection. Roz and Anastasia went to see where she was hanged.
Now we're in an area of Edinburgh's old town called the Lawn Market. And Roz, look, here we can see some brass markers on the ground. What are they?
Yes, these brass markers actually mark the site of execution in Edinburgh between 1785 and 1864. And basically, we're standing pretty much on the very spot where Mary McKinnon was executed on the 16th of April, 1823.
What do we know about her hanging?
Well, we know that lots of people came to see it. So somewhere between 15,000 people, could be as many as 30,000 people, turned up in this space to watch her being hanged. So if you can imagine, by 8 a.m, this whole area was a sea of people. Now, apparently, at about 8:20 in the morning, Mary McKinnon began her procession from the lockup house down the hill up Liberton's Wynd to this place of execution.
You know, it must have been daunting. She must have been scared.
Yeah, I imagine she probably was pretty scared, but we know from the reports that she died well. By that I mean she didn't struggle against her fate. She did, according to one report, make a brief address to the crowd to proclaim her innocence, and actually pointed the finger at one of the other women in the brothel, saying that it was actually her who stabbed him. But then she very calmly had the noose put around her neck, and as they say in those days, she was launched into eternity.
15,000 to 30,000 people. That's an awful lot of people to turn up to a hanging. Why was that, Roz?
It was because Mary McKinnon was a woman, and hangings of women were a much rarer event. Her case had also been reported in the newspapers and in other forms of popular print. I've got an example here of some of the things you could buy at the time, which I'll pass to you now.
The biographical account of Mary McKinnon, who was executed at Edinburgh for the murder of William Howard.
Yeah, so that's quite a substantial pamphlet. And also, for 1 shilling, you could purchase a portrait of Mary McKinnon. And we have that there.
Hey,
and the portrait,
is that her face?
That's Mary McKinnon.
That's Mary McKinnon.
And the portrait was done when she was awaiting her execution.
Is that somebody holding up a mirror
so
that she can see herself?
Yeah.
So in this picture, she looks extremely matronly. She's wearing a cap and a shawl, and she's a comfortable-looking lady, I'd say.
Next to the biography there, you see the lament of Mary McKinnon. Now, these were verses that were sold as a sheet, and then people would sing them in the streets for entertainment. And you see that one in particular, for example, one of the verses, "My case, let the impartial view it. Time, the further truth shall tell. I am guiltless of the blood of Howard. Heaven receive me. Earth, farewell."
I don't believe for a second that she actually wrote that, but it's interesting that people thought it would sell, that she was, you know, stating her innocence in this high-flown and poetic form.
Another thing you could buy was a broadside. Broadsides were cheap sheets, which specialised in sensational news, sometimes made up, sold on street corners and at the foot of the scaffold on execution days. As well as covering McKinnon's trial and executions, the broadsides also included details of her past. They suggested that as a young woman, she had been seduced, possibly impregnated, by an army officer and then abandoned. Whether true or not, it's a stereotype, a moral cautionary tale, warning girls against premarital sex.
Anastasia, Mary McKinnon seems to have been living at the beginning of this new feeling in society that we needed to get tough on sex work. And you've highlighted how that's affected our laws right up until today. But is there anything people are doing to try to address these old laws and update them?
So there's many campaigns here in Scotland and also throughout the UK to really think about how those laws are effectively putting sex workers into danger, exacerbating risk and vulnerability to violence, and how we might update them to more better reflect sex workers' rights and also to enable them to access justice in cases of violence against them.
Are there any countries where you think they're getting it right?
So the way that in the UK campaigns are going at the moment is largely to criminalise the buyer of sexual services, which is an approach legally that first was introduced in Sweden and has since been exported to Ireland and Northern Ireland, also to Norway and to North America actually as well. Now, the effects of criminalising the buyer have largely been to push the industry underground. Where I believe that it has been done right, however, is where sex work has been affected and fully decriminalised, for example, in New South Wales, Australia, and then followed by New Zealand in 2003. And speaking to the sex workers there in New Zealand, they have far greater choice around how to work, who to work with, and they have much greater and unabated access to things like health services, access to justice and to employment tribunals. And that's very much the model that's held up by sex worker-led organisations globally as to the kind of gold standard, although decriminalised very much seen as a vital but first step.
I am learning a lot here about a group of people in society who I really don't know enough about. Anastasia, as somebody who's spoken to a lot of sex workers, what do you want me to take away about them as a group of human beings?
I think that's exactly it. Many people have not, as far as they're aware, met or come into contact with a sex worker. So really seeking out those sex worker voices and experiences firsthand and supporting calls for decriminalisation and for sex workers' rights to be vindicated more broadly.
Hundred years on from Mary McKinnon, the law in Britain about sex work is evolving, even if not as quickly as it is in other parts of the world. But some things still happen today that Mary McKinnon would sadly recognise. There's an intolerance towards sex work, culturally, morally, which means that sex workers are vulnerable to violence. There's much that's hidden about their lives. Maybe it's time to shine a light, to learn more about it, to listen to what the actual women involved have to say. Thank you to our guest detective, Dr. Anastasia Ryan, and of course to Professor Rosalind Crone. Next time on Lady Killers, we're joined by broadcaster and former political advisor, Aisha Hazarika, to discuss our cases in the series so far. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Hannah Fisher, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Jonathan Keeble, Jacob Smith, Katie Duff, and Fraser Coutts. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4.
What happens when a life coach takes over your life? For the last 18 months, I've been investigating claims that a UK mentoring company is actually a cult.
What we're doing is helping human beings actually gain control of themselves, not for us to gain control of you.
I don't know who I am anymore, bro. Absolutely no idea.
The only money he had to give them was his house.
Controlling its members.
It was more about apportioning blame to my parents.
these toxic groups called families.
Intimidating critics.
When I'd ask questions,
they said, if you leave and you turn against us, we have all those personal recordings of yours.
We'll come for you next.
How do you feel, Paul, about the fact that so many people think you're running a cult?
We're not running a cult. Because they don't know what a cult is. They're slurring us. They're smearing us.
I'm Katrin Nye, and from BBC Radio 4, this is A Very British Cult. Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is not the future we were promised. Like, how about that for a tagline for the show?
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work and your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.